This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Today's the day. By day's end, Virginia's governor is required to finalize any vetoes or amendments to legislation approved by this year's regular General Assembly session. And some big issues have been left to the end. New funding plans for transportation, requiring voters to have photo IDs, whether to go forward with Medicaid expansion, even whether discrimination can be allowed on college campuses. In the hour ahead, we'll parse through what's already been decided, what's likely to happen next, and then on to national issues also affecting Virginia, like, guns, gay marriage, those federal budget cuts that were predicted to affect tens of thousands of Virginia jobs. Of course, if you've got a perspective on anything political, your views will be invited too when this Virginia Politics Update edition of Insight gets underway right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Politics, our focus today, and if you've got an opinion to share or a question to offer, you are invited to join in at 888-WMRA-TALK. Today, Monday, March 25th, is the day Virginia's governor is required by law to finalize his actions on all legislation sent to him by this year's 2013 General Assembly session. So, we have a host of state issues to look at, but this is the week when some hot-button national issues that could affect all of us are also much in the news. Guns, same-sex marriage, the sequester among them. So whatever politics topic is of concern to you, please do join us at 888-967-2825. With us by phone from the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, Virginia political reporter Shelley-Ann Davis, here in the Insight studio, James Madison University professor of political science, Bob Roberts. Thank you both and welcome.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
So, Shelley-Ann, I'm guessing this is a busy day for reporters in Richmond. Lots of decisions expected out of the governor's office today or sometime before midnight.
Yeah, I mean, it usually winds up being busier tomorrow simply because every governor that I've ever covered pretty much waits until midnight for the biggest decisions. And even in a 24-hour news cycle, you know, that's a little late for getting it in the physical paper the next day.
Is there a reason for
that? Lots of decisions. I have no particular knowledge of any reason for that, unless it's just human nature to wait to the last minute.
Bob Roberts, is there a political strategy behind?
No, it's just they're making their decisions at the last minute, and there are a lot of very controversial decisions. They're trying to weigh the minuses and the advantages, and everything comes down to the last minute, as we learned.
I was wondering if you know that whatever decision you make on some of the big issues is going to tick some group off. So you wait till the last minute so that there's less time between when you sign, veto, or amend legislation and when the reconvene session of the General Assembly comes up, which is, 10 days later?
Right.
Yeah, it's like April 3rd. I'm not sure it makes that much difference if you yelled at on Monday or on Tuesday.
It really does.
Well, tell us some of the big decisions that we should hear by tomorrow.
Well, transportation is probably one of the biggest ones, the big transportation funding reform bill, and the governor will have to decide whether to amend parts of that. He's not likely to veto it since he wanted it in the first place, although a lot of sort of conservative Republicans have been asking him to do so. He probably is likely to amend it. I know the Times-Dispatch reported today that he may change or reduce that $100 a year hybrid fee on alternative fuel vehicles, which has been pretty unpopular. And on Friday evening, the Attorney General issued an opinion saying that some components of the regional taxes for Northern Virginia and for Hampton Roads he thought were unconstitutional. That's not a binding opinion, but it is something that the governor might take into account.
This is a big deal, Bob Roberts. So for those people who are not yet familiar with all the ins and outs of this new transportation funding plan, we ought to underscore a couple of things. One is it's been more than 25 years since the General Assembly approved a new plan that was found to be constitutional, that funded or brought in extra funding streams for building roads and other aspects of transportation in the state. And this new plan includes, well, Shelley-Ann just mentioned, the hybrid tax. You want to tell us about that?
$100, if you own a hybrid, you have to pay $100 to the state.
A year.
A year. on the grounds that you're not going to be paying gas taxes or the gross receipts tax, sales tax.
Or at least as much.
As much.
And a hybrid uses some,
but in the sense that you're using the roads and therefore you should pay for the roads. That's the logic behind it.
And as Shelley was just mentioning, I think Shelley, because the governor's taken so much heat on this, his original idea, that he may reduce that $100 to some lower amount.
Yes, that is what I am hearing. I guess we'll see when he actually posts things, you know, probably around midnight.
But and then the other thing is 0.3 of an increase in the state sales tax,
right,
from 5% to 5.3%.
And the big difference, the big change is the doing away with the gas tax and replacing with a gross receipts tax.
Okay, so the gas tax in Virginia, it's currently one of the lowest in the nation.
Right.
It's 17.5 cents.
Right. Right. It's a per gallon flat tax currently and has been since 1986, which doesn't grow.
And so what they're
doing, the argument was to change it to something that was a percentage tax, which might grow some.
And it's a percentage put on the wholesaler.
Wholesale.
When you go to the pump, you won't even see it.
It'll just it's already been factored in by
built
the time you
in.
Get to the pump.
It's going to be northern states have been using this for a long, long time.
And this is a kind of sales tax.
Yes, a sales tax.
Because at 3.5%.
Right.
A wholesale tax, as the cost of a gallon of gas goes up, the amount of tax goes up, just like with a sales tax. If something used to cost a dollar in Virginia and you paid a 5 cent tax per dollar and then the price went up to $2, you would be paying 10 cents.
And it's higher in Northern Virginia and Tidewater. So it's supposed to be 6% in those areas.
And that's what Shelley was saying, that the state attorney general, Ken Cuccinelli,
right,
has offered an opinion,
right,
that he thinks is not constitutional for taxes to be different in different parts of the state.
I think what he's saying is it's unconstitutional for the legislature to raise a local tax. In other words, as I read the opinion, what he was saying is that that power to raise a local tax is delegated to a local area. And what the state legislature did came up with a differential tax for Tidewater and Northern Virginia. The problem with that opinion, in my perspective, is this is a Dillon's Rule state, which means the state legislature can do anything it wants with respect to a locality. So I really don't think that Bob Marshall, who's going to sue on this one, he sued and derailed the last transportation package. Bob Marshall from Northern Virginia. I don't think the Supreme Court of Virginia is going to strike this one down. I'd be very, very surprised if they do.
And of course, as Shelley was noting, we still have to see just how the transportation bill that was a compromise between Republicans and Democrats in Virginia's state legislature, the General Assembly, is going to look once the governor gets done with his ability to amend it or veto parts of it or sign the whole thing just as is. And Shelley, and some of the other big issues that are going to be decided in the governor's office today, what to do about Medicaid expansion, what to do about voter ID, what else?
Right. Those are two fairly big ones. Medicaid expansion is actually, it's not a separate bill. It's within the budget amendment. Okay. And lawmakers had agreed at the last minute on sort of language that puts power to decide on that expansion with a small commission of lawmakers, and Cuccinelli again says he thinks that's not constitutional. So the governor will have to decide what to do about that. Photo ID, you know, that's a bill that would require voters to show an ID with a photograph at the polls. I'm not sure where the governor's going to go on that one. He has said back during session that he thought that Virginia's current laws, which were changed just last year regarding ID at the polls, were adequate. Another big one is a bill that bans texting while driving. I think it may be a secondary offense in Virginia now, but the bill would make it a primary offense, which means a policeman can pull you over specifically for that. But I know a lot of lawyers in the General Assembly have raised questions about that. They've said, well, how is he going to know if you're texting? What if you're looking at your phone to answer a phone call, which is still legal? They feel like there's a lot of gray area in that, so I'm not sure what the governor's going to do with that.
How can the governor deal with the I'm confused on the Medicaid. That was put in the budget.
Get in line.
that was put in the budget. And,
right,
and therefore, for him to tamper with that, as I understand, mm-hmm, that would require him to veto the budget.
No, I think he can do line item amendments.
You can line item that?
Yeah.
Okay. Because my understanding of the deal was to prevent the governor from doing that. But you're saying that the Democrats wouldn't go along with transportation unless they received assurance from the governor that he
wouldn't tinker with the language. That is correct.
So
and he did send them a letter that they felt was assurance enough.
Okay.
And this all relates.
You know, that was in February. Right. And now
okay.
we're looking at April.
Okay.
This all relates to whether or not Virginia is going to participate in the expansion of Medicaid would come to fruition under the new federal health care law when it goes into full effect next year in 2014.
Right.
The idea that we've heard is that if Virginia agrees to that expansion, about 400,000 more people in Virginia would be covered by Medicaid, and the federal government would pay the full cost of that increase for 3 years, and then the federal government's share of that cost would drop to 90%. And the state of Virginia would have to chip in 10%. But Bob Roberts, you've noted before that lots of people in the medical profession were pushing really hard for Republicans in Virginia who had opposed signing on to Medicaid expansion to change their mind.
Hospitals primarily. The hospitals were very, very much concerned that they would be left out of millions and millions of dollars of additional money that they're not being reimbursed for. And therefore, they put a heavy amount of pressure on the legislature to do something to extend Medicaid. Now, whether the concessions that the governor got from the Department of Health and Human Services to provide the state with enough flexibility to, let's say, reform the Medicaid program was enough for the governor, we don't know. But his health secretary got concessions from the Obama administration to allow greater flexibility in how Virginia operated the Medicaid program, and, you know, we'll see what the governor does.
With us on this edition of Virginia Insight, political reporter and state capitol bureau chief for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star newspaper, Shelley Ann Davis, and from James Madison University's Department of Political Science, public policy watcher Bob Roberts. I'm Tom Graham. Our phone number, easy to remember, is 888-WMRA-TALK. Or if you prefer, you can post a question or comment to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. We have this, Shelley, and I think I ought to toss to you, since Bob already talked a little bit about this, we'll get your response on this issue, too. This is from Jessica on Facebook, who says, I am sorry, but I just do not get the logic of an extra tax on hybrid cars. Aren't we supposed to be trying to cut down on pollution? Doesn't that save the state money? Yes, hybrid vehicles use less gas, but don't we make up for lower gas tax payments with other savings?
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely an argument that opponents of that tax have been made, have been making. And I think that the argument the governor has made for the additional hybrid fee is focused pretty solely on they're not paying as much gas tax when they're still on the road. So, you know, it's been very narrowly focused on just that equation and not really looked at, the larger, I guess, implications of whether you're saving everybody money if you're driving a more fuel efficient or, you know, not even using fuel vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, that's and I would say the hybrid owners would argue since their cars are lighter generally because that's how they're more fuel efficient, that they're really not doing that much damage to the roads.
Well, it sounds like Jessica's making another argument that if they're responsible for emitting less pollution, that also, in the long run, saves the state money.
That's hard to quantify in how much the state is saving in terms of money with less pollute. The state is saving. Clearly, individuals are benefiting from that since not enough pollution, might not have enough asthma, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not sure how much that really saves the state in terms of...
It has been giving the late-night comedian some fodder for talking about Virginia once again.
Yes,
we've got lots of other issues to look at, both state and national. A couple more questions just came in on our Facebook page, however you want to refer to it. And Shelley Ann Davis just published, or her newspaper published, her fascinating story titled How Much for That Surgery? It Depends, telling us something important about what's going on in Virginia. We'll take a closer look at that in just a few moments. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. I'm sorry we were having too much fun talking to each other on the break to pay attention to the clock, but we're back now. Bob Roberts has authored numerous books on American politics and public policy. He's a professor of politics at James Madison University. Also with us, Virginia politics watcher and reporter for the freelance Star newspaper, Shelley and Davis. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Our phone lines are open at 888-WMRA. Talk and all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. If you have any questions or comments about anything political, Virginia-wise, nation-wise, both. It looks like Mike on our Facebook page has something that I guess touches on both. Mike asks, if the Supreme Court legalizes same-sex marriage, how will that affect Virginia's anti-gay laws?
If the court issues a broad decision saying under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment that a state may not prohibit gay marriage, then Virginia will have to change its laws.
Maybe we should get a refresher on just what's before the Supreme Court. It's getting argued this week.
Right. There's DOMA, which is the Defense of Marriage Act.
That's a federal law.
Federal law.
That says marriage has to be between one man and one woman. And one of the complications now that the military allows you to serve openly in the military, right, if you're gay, has been the question of whether or not lesbians and gays serving in the military can get partner benefits.
That's correct.
And the federal government has said,
no,
you can't, because DOMA prohibits us from doing,
right,
this. Okay.
And then we have Proposition, I forgot in Cal what we call
it. Eight.
Eight.
In California,
which in a sense defines marriage as only between a man and a woman. And the Attorney General of California refuses to enforce it. And so the Supreme Court now has a choice. It can defer to the states. It simply can say, this issue is for the states to decide. Much like Roe v. Wade was decided, abortion was regulated prior to Roe v. Wade. Or it can say as a grand decision, in other words, it could say that under the 14th Amendment, there is no compelling state interest to prohibit marriage between same gender individuals.
So, Shelley, with Mike's question, if the Supreme Court legalizes same-sex marriage, how will that affect Virginia's anti-gay laws? I'm guessing that he's referring to Virginia's law that declares marriage as being between one man and one woman.
Right. In Virginia's constitution, there is, you know, also a provision that says marriage must be between one man and one woman.
And that was through voter referendum, right?
2006.
It was, and it was just a few years ago. It has not been on the books that long.
Right.
So, you know, and I'm no lawyer, but I assume that you know, Bob is right in that if the federal Supreme Court says, if they, you know, knock that down and make sort of a federal blanket ruling about that, I guess it would, I guess, knock down Virginia's one. But that is something that even I would be calling lawyers to make sure I understood,
right,
before I wrote about it. So that's what I think would happen. So,
but I'm guessing. Yeah. Mike's reference to anti-gay laws makes me wonder. I don't know that there's any other legislation on the books that might be characterized that way, but there has been an attempt in recent years, including this most recent General Assembly session that ended last month, to create new legislation that would outlaw discrimination against homosexuals. And Shelley, in that attempt hasn't been getting very far?
No, it hasn't. And you know, you'll forgive me because I didn't follow this year's bill very closely. In my memory of years past, it was sort of a legal argument about whether it was up to the General Assembly to make those laws, whether they were needed when the state has policies about preventing or prohibiting discrimination within state employment.
And universities. And
I beg your pardon?
And universities. A lot of the when Governor Kaine had his executive order, whereby he ordered that the state all state agencies, not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. And
right.
And so Governor Attorney General Cuccinelli raised questions about that, whether that was permissible under state law. And the governor early on in his term, came up.
Current governor, Bob McDonnell.
Came up with a compromise, in other words, saying there's a policy that we don't, state agencies do not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation, but it's not clear what the remedy is if such discrimination occurs.
Well, speaking of discrimination, Shelley, and there has been another piece of legislation that I understand that you've been following that was approved by the General Assembly earlier this year. Still, we're awaiting this with many other issues on the governor's desk today to see whether he's going to sign it or not. Basically, it would allow groups, primarily religious groups, on college campuses in Virginia to discriminate. Can you tell us more about that?
It's a bill that is from Senator Mark Obenshain, and it essentially says that colleges cannot stop college clubs, like student clubs, from choosing who to associate with. Basically, it would say that college clubs have to be allowed to choose their own officers and make their own membership rules. And it's meant, if you follow the Obenshain line of reasoning, it's meant to make sure that, say, if you're the College Baptist Association, that you don't get, you know, an atheist who wants to come join you and is, you know, who believes things counter to your club's mission. Or if you were the College Republicans, you wouldn't have to let a Democrat run for, you know, the presidency of your club. The ACLU has opposed that bill and says it basically lets college clubs discriminate against students, and that there are college clubs who are funded, you know, especially in public universities through public funds. And so they say it would be allowing them to discriminate against, you know, other groups.
Yeah, it's particularly important on the funding issue because large numbers of college groups do get funding through the student fees. And so right. The ACLU is making that strong argument that you will be condoning, in other words, state funds going to organizations that discriminate. On the other hand, some of the groups argue it's kind of, you know, just doesn't make much sense if I have a Baptist group or a Methodist group or a Catholic group to say I have to allow someone in my group who doesn't believe in what the group believes in, you know, religiously. So there are two sides of the issue. I think the funding issue is more important, that can you allow any form of discrimination if you're receiving government funds?
We got this just came in on our Facebook page from Robert, who says, you may have addressed this in earlier programs, but if not, could you please explain why in the world the governor reappointed Ms. Dragas as rector of UVA? And once he did, why in the world the General Assembly did not block it? Does she have some sort of political and or financial muscle of which we ordinary mortals are unaware?
Well, she could. I mean, but essentially what the governor said was that I think once the situation was sort of resolved at UVA last year and the president was reinstated, he said that it's, you know, not his role and not the state government's role to micromanage. That once you've appointed these people to these boards, you shouldn't micromanage them. And so I think that was sort of the line of reasoning followed by the legislature as well. But, I mean, yes, he did decide to reappoint her, reappoint Dragas, and she was up for reappointment, and the legislature confirmed that. So
I follow the Facebook postings of many of the legislators from our area, and I believe this was one from Cree Deeds during the point in time when the General Assembly was considering whether to reappoint Ms. Dragas as rector at UVA. Cree, I apologize if I've got this wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was a Facebook post from you where you were noting the degree of surprise that you and other opponents of Ms. Dragas in the legislature saw no one show up to the legislative hearings who opposed. You know, they got lots of petitions, lots of online petitions, lots of student commentary that please do not reappoint Ms. Dragas after what happened at UVA last summer. But nobody showed up at the hearings. The people who did show up at the hearings were people who supported her.
That really doesn't surprise me that much. In a sense, you have to understand that that if you're even students or faculty members, etc., to openly oppose the head of the Board of Visitors is a pretty, you know, dramatic step to do. And I think generally there was probably some apprehension in terms of the opponents to the publicly the publicly make a statement. I think they believe they had already made their point and probably didn't underestimate the fact that governors and the legislature really do not like to micromanage appointments to boards of visitors as a matter of precedent. If you start here, then where does it end? And I think that's basically what happened. In other words, they weren't going to start down this path. And because the board members have terms, you have a limit of 2 terms, you're not going to be there forever. And therefore, why have a president and everybody attacking board members? And so the legislature decided to defer to tradition.
Let's talk about guns, because this is both a national issue that a lot of publicity coming out of Washington about this. But they're also, again, to mention State Senator Mark Obenshain, who is a Republican, quite conservative senator from the Valley, got another piece of legislation that he sponsored, signed by the governor a couple of days ago, that has to do with protecting the names and identities of people who have concealed carry permits in Virginia. And I want to read to you a few paragraphs from an editorial published in the Richmond Times-Dispatch just yesterday, where they take the senator and also the governor who signed the senator's bill to task. Quote, State Senator Mark Obenshain and Governor Bob McDonnell have it backward. Last week, the governor signed a bill the lawmaker sponsored to exempt concealed carry permit information from the Freedom of Information Act. Obenshain claims that exercising a constitutional right should not land your personal information on someone else's list with a government assist. Really? Then we'd like to see the senator immediately propose legislation forbidding political parties, consultants, and candidates to access voter registration records. Voting, of course, is a constitutional right, and political campaigns routinely use personal voter information collected by the State Board of Elections to compile lists for their outreach efforts. That is precisely how they get your address to mail you those glossy campaign brochures. Obenshain is running for the GOP nod for Attorney General. We assume he will not be using any voter information from the State Board of Elections in his own campaign. Voter records are not the only private information collected by the state that is available for public view, so are property transfers and real estate assessments. You can even look that information up on the internet. The right to property is a fundamental right, just like the right to self-defense, but the right to property is not impaired because county government records and disclose property values or transfers. And there's a few more paragraphs, but you get the basic point. Bob Roberts, does the Richmond Times-Dispatch, which obviously has an interest in freedom of information, have a point that it is somewhat paradoxical to argue that one group of people's records should not be subject to a Freedom of Information Act, but other people should?
I think Senator Obenshain has argues another point of view here, that if anyone could determine whether you have a concealed weapons permit, it would enable them to know whether you have weapons. And therefore, if they wanted to rob you of your weapons, they would know where to go to rob someone with weapons, etc. So I think his argument, it created a safety issue as well as a privacy, you know, constitutional privacy issue. Now, whether you agree with that or not, I mean, the notion that a public record should be available to the public is basically on the theory of transparency, that we want as much information out there about when you are engaging in public transactions. And getting this type of public transaction probably should be available to the public. But on the other hand, he's arguing it might put someone's security in jeopardy. The governor agreed with him.
Well, if you listening have an opinion about the Obenshain bill or anything else going on with guns or anything else going on with politics, you're welcome to join us at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. If you have a question for James Madison University's Bob Roberts or the Fredericksburg Freelance Stars, Shelley and Davis. Of course, you can also reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And Shelley and Davis, not to ask you to pick on a competing newspaper, But I wondered when I read that editorial from the Richmond Times-Dispatch, it seems to me that I cannot easily access information about somebody's driver's license. Or if I see the license plate on the back of a car and I don't like their behavior on the road, I can't just find out who that person is and what their address is, can I?
Well, no. I mean, yes, the government has picked and chose which information that comes through a government thing, which is really public and which is just sort of public. But I would say that you can go to the courthouse and find out who in your acquaintance has gotten divorced or has bought a house or sold a house. So there are, you know, sort of a different grades, I guess, in the level of public that is for public information. To use the example that the Times-Dispatch used, while our voting records are not public, you and I can't go down to the registrar and find out how our neighbors are voting. You know, campaigns can. I mean, they buy those. They buy those lists. And they don't know who you voted for in the booth, but they know every time you went and voted in a primary or a general election or anything else.
And the driver's issue was interesting because at one time you could call up DMV until the federal government intervened. There was a federal law passed to protect your driver's license information on the grounds it might threaten your privacy and security, someone who was stalking you, etc. So we do prohibit that for privacy reasons.
You know, Shelley, I really wanted to get to this great article that was published in your paper yesterday, bylined with your name, about transparency in medicine in Virginia and across the nation. But all of a sudden, mentioning guns and all our phone lines lit up. So we may have to hold off on that for a moment to get to some of these calls. We've got Laszlo here with us, who's been driving somewhere along the interstate. Laszlo, your question or comment for Bob Roberts and or Shelley and Davis, please.
My comment would be about the concealed carry permit holders and their names being available.
Yes.
I don't actually have a problem with them being available. My problem would be more with the news media publishing them to make a point for political reasons. And so I think that there's, this bill wouldn't have even been introduced and wouldn't have even been passed and signed into law had it not been for the newspaper publishing the names of the concealed carry permit people up in Connecticut, which was pretty much outrageous, but it was part of a liberal media bias to out people who were carrying guns because they thought it was outrageous. No more different than the Child Protective Service worker that walked into the home and wanted to examine guns and write down information about a gentleman's guns in Connecticut after he bought his son a .22 rifle for his birthday. And I don't agree with him putting it on Facebook, just as a thing of general common sense, but there was nothing illegal about it. And, she brings four police officers to the guy's house to examine his guns, and she had no right to do that.
Laszlo, hold on just a moment. We're about to go to the break. Bob Roberts, I think one of the things that Laszlo's referring to was actually a New York newspaper that published the names of gun owners in Connecticut. And it's my understanding that once something is accessible through a Freedom of Information Act, you cannot prevent
Absolutely.
The media
public
from
record.
Publishing.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this was the only way to prevent that.
Yeah. In fact, the only way you could prevent it is by exempting that public record from disclosure.
Laszlo, thank you so very much for your call. Charlie in Harrisonburg, you're going to be next on the line when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Shelley-Ann Davis researches and writes about politics and public policy as a reporter for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star newspaper. Bob Roberts researches and teaches public policy and politics at James Madison University. So Shelley-Ann and Bob are our guests. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Charlie, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, this I hate to go back to something you already talked about, but this is back to
the gas tax.
Oh,
I love it when we do that.
On the gas tax issue, my question is, since we are doing away with the gas tax anyway and we're going to be paying it through sales tax, why should we discriminate against people who have hybrid cars?
The argument traditionally has been if I use the roads, We're not discriminating against hybrid cars, the government argues.
I'm not sure you heard what Charlie's question was.
Yeah.
Charlie says you're getting rid of the gas tax. And I think he may be missing a key element. The 17.5 cent per gallon tax is going away.
Right.
But people who drive cars and put gasoline in their cars are still going to be paying a tax.
Correct.
It's just that wholesale tax that's buried in.
Right. It's a sales tax on gasoline.
Okay. So, Charlie, if you buy a lot of gas, you still pay a lot of tax.
All right. Then what about the people who drive very fuel-efficient cars? Some fuel cars are more fuel-efficient that are not hybrids than some hybrids. So to discriminate against a hybrid because it's a hybrid is really bad.
I agree with you. I think, to me, we want to encourage people to buy hybrids. So to me, this makes no sense at all because you want people to use less gas. But the governor is reverting back to a classic view of how we pay for roads. If you're on the roads, you should pay for them. And so this goes back to a early 20th century when we first began to use automobiles and gas taxes, etc., that the governor is saying, if you're on the roads, you should pay for them. And therefore, a hybrid will use a lot less gas. I disagree.
Is this by any chance an anti-Democrat tax that you figure that there are very few in the Republican base who have Priuses, but there are lots of Democrats who do?
I think it's really an anti-alternative energy tax. In a sense, the governor has made quite clear he's very supportive of drilling, use of hydrocarbons, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is a kind of saying all this alternative energy, these hybrids, et cetera, are not really going to solve our problems. We need to build roads, maintain roads, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's what this is. And
Well, I'll point out.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. The governor has converted the state fleet, I believe, to alternative fuel vehicles.
Yes, he has. I agree.
So is the state government going to have to pay itself $100 a vehicle?
No, state.
I guess so.
I don't know. I don't think it makes any sense.
Charlie, there apparently are lots of people who feel just like you who have been contacting the governor's office, and that's why we're hearing rumors that the governor is going to decrease that fee from $100 to something at least a little bit less than that. But obviously we won't know for sure until we get official word out of the governor's office later today. Thank you so very much for your call. So Shelley and Davis from the Fredericksburg Freelance Star, this article you wrote titled "How Much for That Surgery? It Depends." Tell us a little bit about what you found.
Well, yeah. So that was based on a group had given last week all the states grades based on how transparent their laws are or what their laws are requiring transparency in healthcare pricing. So trying to figure out how much it costs hospitals to provide care, how much insurance companies pay for that, you know, all the ramifications of how much things cost when you're getting like a procedure or you're getting something done medically. And Virginia got a B. In Virginia, you actually can find out a lot of information between a couple of different websites. You can look up a lot of data on what individual hospitals charge for a lot of things. You can look up all kinds of information on how various healthcare plans work and how much profit various places are making. What you can't do in Virginia is directly find out how much your insurance will pay for a certain procedure at a certain hospital. That linkage has not been made in Virginia law or in the websites that provide a lot of data currently in the state. And I felt like it was a timely thing to write about because as we were speaking in the break about the Time magazine had done a big piece several weeks ago. I think it was like 36 pages. And it looked a lot at how confusing it can be to get a straight answer from hospitals on how much a procedure will cost, because it varies completely from hospital to hospital. And the hospital, they have what they call charge masters, and that is the rate that the hospital charges. But if you have insurance, your insurance is not paying that rate. They have negotiated a reduction. So it can be very confusing for people to try to find out how much something will cost, especially if you don't have insurance, or especially these days where a lot of people's insurance and or employers are moving to high deductible plans, which means that you're going to be paying more out of your own pocket for procedures, at least until you hit a certain limit.
So if you who are listening have an opinion or a question about transparency in medical costs, we've got a few more minutes to take calls at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825, or anything else political. You can also post to us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And we got this from Nancy, who says, I would like the state to repeal the same-sex marriage ban amendment and to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Three states are needed to pass the ERA. We talked earlier in the show, Bob Roberts, about the same-sex marriage ban in Virginia and how that would be affected if the Supreme Court does, in fact, overturn Virginia's law against same-sex marriage, and it might affect states throughout the nation, including Virginia. So let's do this Equal Rights Amendment thing. Is Nancy right that we could still get an ERA if three more states passed?
Most constitutional scholars would argue the time has passed. We would have to start over again. And therefore, even if three states were able to muster the votes to pass it, there'd be a constitutional challenge to it, and probably the time has passed where you'd have to start all over again.
So the deadline was actually sometime in the 1980s, wasn't it?
Yeah. In the 80s. And then Congress did try to extend it, and there was a controversy over extending it. And at that time, there was a lot of constitutional scholars saying that you would have to, that extension wasn't valid, and it didn't really have that much of an impact, since very few states were willing to, in a sense, go ahead with it.
Hey, Shelley and Davis, at one point in time, it seemed like the governor and his administration were very concerned about this thing out of Washington called the sequester. It went into effect at the beginning of March.
It did, yes.
Have you heard much about it causing ripple effects in Virginia's economy yet?
Right. It's funny. We heard so much more about this during the campaign when everybody was against it, and then it went into effect, and now I don't hear much about it. I think that the effects are, it was not going to be like, you know, one day we don't have it and the next day everything falls apart. It's sort of a slow buildup. So I think you're going to be hearing more about it. You're already hearing a little bit of things, you know, that catch national attention, like no more White House tours. I think I heard the Blue Angels couldn't, you know, make any more dates to fly in shows because of it. But I think gradually, you know, people are going to be starting to get laid off from civilian Department of Defense jobs, or get furloughed, I mean. And I think especially Northern Virginia, it's going to take time, but you would slowly start to see some impact.
And Bob Roberts, I guess that's the point, that in a state where so many jobs are dependent on the federal government, either people employed with the federal government or with firms that have big contracts with the federal government that don't necessarily think of themselves as federal employees, that over time, these cuts could lead to lots of job losses?
Right now, the studies out there say if the cuts remain in effect for 10 years, we could lose as many as 200,000 jobs. And the way it's going to work is by fall, right when the election occurs for governor, lieutenant governor, House of Delegates, we could begin to see a reduction in state revenues. If there are a lot of furloughs in Northern Virginia around the state, those individuals will lose about 20% of their income. And if they lose 20% of their income, state tax receipts are going to go down because income tax will go down. They might not buy as much. So we should be, if it's going to have an impact, we should see it by the fall. And therefore, it could become a major campaign issue in Virginia by fall. If the agencies go ahead, make the furloughs, defense contractors, lay off large numbers of employees, then we may see the beginning to hit home right at the time when voters go to the polls in November.
Out of all of the things, Shelley, and that the governor has to pass on today, I mean, either sign, amend, veto, some combination thereof, is there an issue that we haven't touched on yet that you think is a biggie?
Oh, I think we've covered the biggies that I can recall at the moment. like I said, transportation and Medicaid expansion are definitely the two biggest ones and the ones that have gotten the most attention. And I think photo ID and texting while driving are also big issues. He still hasn't decided about that college club discrimination bill yet either. But I can't really think of anything else that was really big news that's still out there.
Well, then let's pick on the state attorney general a little bit more, since he came up earlier talking about his reflection on the constitutionality or lack thereof of parts of the transportation funding plan and expansion of Medicaid or the structure for doing that. He also made some national headlines last week when Politico published a story claiming that he has a major conflict of interest in a tax case that his office is supposed to be pursuing. Are you familiar with this, Bob Roberts?
He has some stock. I believe it was 10,000 to 50. His only stock holding he has in a particular company.
Star Scientific?
Star Scientific. I think that's his only stock holding in his entire whatever portfolio he has. And the state is involved in a case involving that company. And so the issue is, does he have to recuse himself or his office have to recuse himself from that particular case? Probably not. I mean, there's no law there saying that he has to recuse himself for the amount of stock involved here. It's a relatively small amount of money. I would not, from account of the interest, the way this is dealt with at the federal level and state levels, probably this amount of stock is not enough to argue that he should really recuse himself. So I think this is really more of a political issue than a substantive issue that might hurt him down the road in terms of the fall elections.
Shelley and Davis, I can't pretend to know all the specifics here, but it seems to me that I've heard that the amount in dispute of taxes that a Star Scientific may or may not owe is in the neighborhood of $700,000. And some of the accusations against Mr. Cuccinelli is that his office has been fairly slow in pursuing that money compared to tax cases in the past.
It was not my article. I believe it was the Associated Press that had written about that. And so that was what some people were saying. Yes, it is a $700,000 tax dispute. And it's been, I believe, a number of months, well over a year since there was any new filing in the case. But I couldn't really tell you how unusual that is or not.
Okay. So then that leads us to the governor's race in the 2 minutes that we have left.
Okay.
We now know that we have a Republican candidate for governor and a Democratic candidate for governor. At least we're pretty sure, because the man who was hinting that he may leave the Republican Party to run as an independent finally said, no, I'm not going to do that.
Right. Mr. Bowling, right. Lieutenant Governor Bowling said he's not
Lieutenant Governor Bowling.
So
you talk like I do sometimes, as if we're from New York,
okay.
And we just drop all the syllables. Okay. And some people may not know that Bill Bowling is in his second term as Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. I'll give you a hard time about something else in a moment.
And he was threatening to run as an independent. He's declined. Speculation is he's interested in running for governor in 4 years, and that he did not want to alienate all the Republicans in the state if he decided to do this. So this leaves our two heir apparents to the Mr. Terry McAuliffe, the Democrat, and Attorney General Cuccinelli to go at each other. And they're already going at each other. And the Democrats are trying to make abortion the issue because Attorney General Cuccinelli has been making a number of very conservative stands on abortion. And Cuccinelli campaign is trying to make McAuliffe look like he's an out-of-sider, out-of-stater who has been involved in shady fundraising practices in the past. So it's already getting pretty nasty well before the real race begins.
There is some talk across the country that this race, I think Virginia and
New Jersey
are the only two states that have a governor's race this year. But the Virginia race is being seen as something of a bellwether for the Republican Party, Shelley and Davis, or at least a look at how the Republican Party may or may not re-image itself going into the future?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, this is definitely going to be one of the biggest races in the country. I don't think anybody thinks New Jersey is going to be very competitive, but I think this one is expected to be very competitive in Virginia. And, you know, it comes as you've got national Republicans announcing, you know, new plans to sort of rebrand themselves to try to, you know, reach out to maybe some of the demographic groups that have not traditionally voted Republican in the past, to try to avoid some of the social issues that may have turned off some demographic groups. And then you've got, you know, Cuccinelli as the party standard bearer here in Virginia. And he's a social conservative. And, you know, and Cuccinelli, he's going to do what he wants to do. I would be very surprised to see King Cuccinelli, you know, reshape himself to conform to whatever the National Party is trying to rebrand itself as. You know, he runs on the things that interest him and that he believes and is probably, and I'm just guessing here, probably not that interested in whatever the national GOP would like him to do.
So my guess is that we're going to have plenty to talk about in the months ahead. Our guests
right.
have been by phone the State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Fredericksburg Freelance Star newspaper, Shelley Ann Davis, plus James Madison University Professor of Political Science, Bob Roberts. Thank you both for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about our guests. Virginia Insight's executive producers, Matt Bingay, associate producers, Terry Ward, and Bob Levicky. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.